Good morning. My name is Abigail, and I'm here at, well, we're most Sundays, I think. Usually late, but not today. So, yeah, thank you for Pastor Lane inviting me to speak and just share a little bit about what I did for 2 weeks of my vacation this summer. So I thank you for your prayers. I was at Mission Adventures Camp, which is a camp in Northern Ontario. It's about 5 hours north of Thunder Bay. I was there for 2 weeks. But I guess I just, before I even go into the presentation, I just wanted to start with something here. Seven sacred teachings, the traditional concepts of respect and sharing that form the foundation of Native American, Indigenous Canadian way of life are built around the seven natural laws or sacred teaching. Each teaching honors one of the basic values, three virtues intrinsic to living a full and healthy life. Each law is embodied by an animal to underscore the point that all actions and decisions made by man are manifest on a physical plane. The animal world has taught man how to live close to the earth. The connection that has been established between the animal world and that of man has instilled a respect for all of life in those who follow the traditional way. So I'm going to go back later on. You'll see I'll talk about the wolf, and that the wolf was a theme of the camp for the 2 weeks that I was there. So my journey to Mish, I just wanted to talk about, like, you know, why did I get to Mish? Because some people are like, that was one of those questions at camp. So how did you get here? And like, why you're taking your 2 weeks vacation to go there? That's kind of odd. So I guess I wanted to start, like, I mean, I think I've been on a journey of, in my own spirituality, in terms of thinking about the role of Christianity and how I embrace and explore Christianity as a woman of African descent who comes from descendants of slaves, who's living on colonized land. So what does that mean by embracing this religion that's often seen as the white man's religion? And so what does that mean to me? How do I begin to explore it more deeply and to find a connection that's authentic to me? So one of the things that came up recently was last fall, there was a conference called Reimagine Conference, which was in Hamilton. So I learned about that. I can't remember how. Maybe you shared it with me. Yeah, Pastor Lane shared it with me. She's like, with me. And yeah, so I was like, I think, so I thought I would go to that. And I was particularly drawn to, I mean, they're looking at like neighborhoods, people basically working in neighborhoods and practitioners and the intersection of that and the church in our role as Christians. And one of the workshops that really drew me was around race, equity, and the church. And the person who led that workshop, who I got to know, and a few of us talked afterwards, then invited me to a group called Decolonizing Christianity Canada. And it's a group of Indigenous and racialized Christians in Canada who are really kind of trying to wrestle with some of these questions about, like, what does it mean to be Christian, particularly given our ancestral roots and the experience of our peoples with Christianity, both those who are colonized or those who have been enslaved or those who have been brought over for other reasons that where they're subjugated. So what does that actually mean of people of color to actually be to be Christian in this context, in this modern context here? So I heard a little bit about Nates, but now they just go by Nates to actually have a more like inclusive and broader name, because it also is engages folks more internationally from other countries as well. And so I thought I would go to that. And through that, I met, and he heads up iEmergence, and he told me about Mish Adventure. And for me, it was that sort of confluence of like, okay, doing something that's camp-based, that would be really interesting. Veronica, a few years, had done the camp in Alberta, which is quite different than the one I did. But that was sort of one thing that was on my mind. I knew that was a really great experience for her. For me, on my journey, both in terms of Christianity, in terms of learning the connections of Indigenous perspectives on theology and Christianity. And then finally, just kind of wanting to reconnect with youth in a very different way than how I usually do, which is usually quite formalized, usually in a university setting, and a lot of organizing kind of stuff. So that's how I got to Mish Adventures. So iEmergence, I just wanted to share a little bit about iEmergence. Their mission is really working with younger people, young Indigenous youth and leaders to build up their leadership. And it's really trying to kind of redeem a lot of what has been lost in cultures. So it's really looking at that sort of transition to leadership, building leadership from within the communities based on what the communities are saying is needed. And the Mish Adventures Camp specifically here provides an opportunity for building youth leadership too. So really looking at how do we work with the youth to grow up with them, walk with them, and to build on their own leadership skills, and also to kind of develop them more into Yeah, for them to actually walk into who the Creator designed them to be, apart from all the other stuff that may be in their lives. So, as I said, it's 5 hours north of Thunder Bay, so I flew to Thunder Bay, and then I met the folks from camp for the first time an hour later we're all driving to for 5 hours to Michikagogamon. So Michikagogamon is a full name, Ojibwe Nation, the First Nations, and it was Osnaburg until 1993, so some people also, there's a lot of signage, and it's still kind of known by that. It's very hard to find on the map, so even looking it up, it's like you find the Michikagogamon band office or Michikagogamon nurses station. And part of the reason why it's like not just one community, it's two reserves. There's a couple other communities. And so it involves people who are on reserve and off reserve, as noted up there. And many people still speak Ojibwe. So, I mean, there's many terms that the kids would use, which is also really beautiful because part of it, of what was lost was like, language in the culture, and so that's really beautiful too. I point out those five communities, and these are not a geographical representation of where they actually are. As somebody who works with maps, it's not that. But the reason why I wanted to show that is that there were sort of these six areas, or like sort of sub communities or neighborhoods in a sense. These are the communities where kids were coming from. So they actually all live within driving distance from the community center, which is where the programming was held, but we would pick them up either in a bus every morning, and then those who were close by, they would just walk for 15 or 20 minutes to get to the community center. So yeah, so it was a 10-day camp. It was 2 weeks, 5 days, 5 days. And it's been running for 13 years. So I imagine some of the staff, there's a longer story in terms of how it started. The person who started it, she's no longer engaged in Misadventures, but she's actually working on another program with young women in the community. But one of the people who was originally working with her is also sort of one of the co-directors, and I'll show some pictures of them later on. The other three are women they all kind of are in teaching professions. So two are teachers, and the other one teaches in a university setting. So they basically spend and give their summer essentially to like at least 5 weeks to doing things related to Mish. So the range of people, of kids that you would get, probably about 100, 150 over the years has been changing. This year was a smaller number, partly because there was a lot of issues related to like weather and bus and transportation, which made it more difficult. And there's about 20 youth leaders. So this is a picture here. It's harder to see. It looked clearer before, but these are the youth leaders, and they're ages 12 to probably 17, most of them, but most of them I would say are like 13 and 14. And they're the ones who, if you were to go to the website, like the pictures of them are when they were like 7 and 8 and 9, and they've kind of grown up with the camp or even younger. So it's quite beautiful to see them as being youth leaders in the camp. So next slide. So yeah, so I think I talked a little bit of the sacred teachings, and I just wanted to point to the circle of courage because this is sort of both iEmergence as well as the camp is kind of based on this and trying to, as a model of working, a youth development model of working with youth that may face multiple barriers as well as a way to build up their leadership skills. And so I just thought that was, having done way back a little bit of research around youth development, I just thought it was really interesting and important to mention because that's sort of at the core of how they're working with youth and youth leaders. And I mentioned the seven sacred teachings and humility was the wolf. So humility was really, it really was, the wolf was representing the humility in that it shows deference, and it is not, in terms of if food is found, the wolf would bring it back to the pack and share it with the pack before anything is consumed. And so one of the things we were talking about, and we as part of this principle too, was just around being connected to community, but also not being arrogant, knowing who you are in the Creator, but also sharing that with the community too. So, and that's sort of like the Coles Notes version, but you can always go and look that up, Seven Sacred Teachings, to learn a little bit more about humility. So we tried to like bring that into like the games that we did with the kids. There would be stories we'd share with the kids around teachings of the wolf, or just stories about wolves, which would then demonstrate teachings. And then that little picture there was Hunter the wolf, and so Hunter was hidden, and there are some games in some parts of the week where they actually had to go and find Hunter. So he was a very cuddly wolf. And I didn't mention, but the kids, the youth leaders were 12 to 17-ish, but the kids were supposed to be 6 to 12 or 6 to 11. Sometimes they were as young as 4, and sometimes if they couldn't say their name, we said, no, you can't come to camp. You have to go back because you're too young. So, but they were supposed to be from 6. So every morning we'd have kind of like a map of the community center and talk about all the activities we'd do. So every day was a different set of 15 activities, and we'd go from, we'd have team leaders who would work with the youth as well as like take them around to the different activities, as well as station leaders who would just do the activity. So you learned the activity the night before, and then you did it the next morning, and then we just like rolled with it. So that was sort of how the days went, and it was from 10 until 3, 11 until 3, but the day would actually start 9 to 11 for setup, 3 to 5 for cleanup, and then after that we would go back to where we stayed, dinner, and then prep for the next day, and then start the next day. So that was generally how it worked. And we'd have a bus pickup between 9:30 and 11, as well as a bus drop-off between 3:30 and 5. The first day, and I'm not going to go through every day, but I just thought the first day to give you a sense of like the unpredictable nature of how things happened and how the directors were able to go to the community leaders, the elders in the community, the chief, and talk about, okay, what do we do next? The first day, I don't know, 1:30, some funnel clouds hit us really hard, blew things away. We had to rush the kids inside. The storm came like literally, the sky was like turning, but literally probably about a minute of like, oh, the wind's coming. Oh my goodness, the wind's coming. Get inside, the wind's coming. The kids were inside before, but some of us counselors were still outside. And there's a funny story that one of the women, she was just kind of walking along, not realizing there's this storm brewing behind her, and it kind of looked like Dorothy in the Wizard of Oz. And given that we're in Ozburg, like that was, I was teasing her the whole time. I was like, it was like Kaya in Oz, because she was like walking along. And then one of the directors was like, get inside. And she was like, what? I don't see anything. And then when she turned around, she realized like what was behind her. And literally for the next week, we could find like, oh, that's a cooler that blew into the forest, or that's the blank, like that kind of thing. Like the wind was so, so strong. So that was the first, and that really actually, it made it difficult to get the kids home because the roads were blocked off. Trees had fallen. That's a sign of Mishkegogamon. And it was beautiful, this beautiful lettering. It was crushed. And the interesting thing was that I think there was warnings in Pickle Lake, which is about an hour from Mishkegogamon, but nobody thought that anything was going to happen there. And it actually was, there's just a lot of trees. You could see the trees like knocked over and the pathway. And it was, you know, they're with kids, so the first thing they're thinking about is like, am I going to make it home? Was my parents okay? And like, they're inside, and you know, everything is disruptive. So, and you have like 100 children. So it was interesting in the first day just to like, for that to be the first experience. So these just show you a little bit of different things we did. So they're, you know, crazy dressing. That was one activity where they take pictures. The airdrop, so Treaty Day is a day where a celebration which celebrates it's Treaty 9, James Bay Treaty. So I didn't say from at the beginning, but it was one of the first place where with the Hudson Bay Company in terms of settlers and Europeans coming over in 1600. So a lot of the, like historically, the nations were actually the ones who were guiding in the interior. So James Bay and Osnaburg was actually one of the trading posts there. So Treaty, St. James Bay Treaty, connected to, so they do have celebrations, sort of commemorations around Treaty Day. And part of it is like an airdrop where, and this is the actual drop is more related to a settlement with Hydro than it is with to do with Treaty Day specifically, but it happens, but they'll have these packages of coupons and prizes that kids can get. So it's dropped from an airplane, and then they'll just go and open them and they get their prize and they go and claim their prize. So the day when that happened, it's, again, you can't really see it. It was cloudy, but literally, like the airdrop happened. The envelopes came down, and it was a little bit windy, and a lot of them flew into the forest. So most of the older kids got them, and the younger kids were a little bit upset. But then we were able to redistribute a little bit. But it was it's like one of those things where the first day it was canceled, and the second day it actually happened, and they were very excited. There was square dancing, so this was just something with the community, and it was the adults there, the chief was there, some of the elders. And what was really neat was that, like, you know, you have these kids, they're listening to all the pop music and hip-hop the whole time, and then square dancing happens, and they come out, and you're just like, he can square dance? And they can square dance, like, it's so well. It was just pretty amazing, because you just were like, I wouldn't think that you're going to get, you'd be into this so much. So it was really, really neat to see some of the older youth come up and know, and just square dance so well and just really be enjoying themselves. So I guess I just wanted to say like what were my learnings. And I think one of the biggest things I saw was just like the idea of a relationship, like all my relations, and just not just a relationship to each other, but like the openness to relationship, the welcoming spirit of the community, both the youth, the kids, as well as the elders or older people who are working in the community. And I think also just like that the connection to land and how that was so, just comments the kids would make and like, oh, that's the Thunderbirds are flying. My dad says that this is what's happening when they hear this or they see this. And it was just really neat to see their observations, because it wasn't somebody who was 10, often it was like 8 or 7, and to hear that, I think their openness just to like, to love and to people who were new in their lives. Like, they didn't know me. A lot of them were like, your skin is a lot darker. Why? And your hair. But there's still that sort of openness and just the connectedness that you can, even in a very short time, build with the kids and also with the youth. Like, I had a lot of fun, like, you know, playing soccer. One of the guys complimented me on my soccer skills, and I have no soccer skills. So he was being very generous, but just hanging out with the youth and being able to build the relationship that way. And I think for me, it was just, it really, I guess, just showed how we can share our time, how we can be open to both immerse ourselves in a community and be willing to learn and see how we can serve. So I went wanting to go to serve and to learn, and I think I was able to do both, but also receive a lot from the youth and just from really beautiful people in the community when I knew I'm entering a community, and they were just really, really, really welcoming. It's one thing I can't, and I still remember the chief saying, or the past chief saying the last day, like, they had a dinner for us and they said, yes, we're all treaty people, and we want to know how we can live and work together on this land, in these lands.
Before you left, I'd ask, like, how could we be supporting you? And you didn't really have, other than us praying for you, but you did have ideas of how we can support the camp. So can you just share a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So I guess I had asked one of the directors. She was the one who kind of went through my application process, like, how can we support, or is there anything that can be done? And she said, and I said, well, what's the cost of, you know, sending kids to camp generally? So it's about $25. There's no charge to the kids. It's free for them, but it's about $25 for them to go. And part of the reason why is that they, like, individual people give donations, like, as counselors, like, we'll pay for our own trip up there and things like that. But the accommodation was actually generously paid for by the band this year. Typically, we'll stay in the teachers' houses on the school, but they actually put us somewhere else because of that. That was under construction. So the band council paid for our accommodation. So that wasn't a cost. Pay for our travel, so that's not a cost. And there's a lot of donations that they also collect. So one of the co-directors, I think a family member or something, has connections to like a transport company. So all the goods that are collected in Southern Ontario can actually be transported up there almost at no charge for the camp. So one way is certainly donations of supplies and food, which they collect almost all year long. Lots of craft supplies. Of course, the food stuff would be non-perishables, but a lot of the craft stuff, I would say, like games, sports things, and equipment. And then also just financial donations. So that was one email that I sent out. I included Pastor Lane on. I sent it out to many family and friends saying, would you consider donating to the camp? And they would go directly to the website. So those are sort of like two ways, like the financial donation. And then also how I did it. Like, I actually just volunteered my time by going up. And I mean, of course, they can only accommodate so many people, but there's probably other ways of being able to support. So I guess I wanted to highlight those.